Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guest is Phil Neal. We're going to be talking about Phil's new book, Hinterland, America's New Landscape of Class and Conflict. Loved this book, loved everything about it, from how it's written to the subject matter. You know, in today's times, when we think about radical struggle, we think about cities, we think about downtown, financial districts, and what Phil does in his book is sort of takes a look at, like, what that looks like going outward, you know, everywhere from the rural to the suburban to the ex-urban to the logistic cities, and how all these things are interconnected all over the world, and how capitalism is not just centrally located, you know, downtown in the financial district like it was. And and just sort of like what those trends are looking like, and what we should be thinking about as we're moving into the future. Fuck them. Okay. And what we should be looking at as we're moving into the future, but also taking a really critical and nuanced look at, you know, quote unquote, Trump country. And while that's not what this book is about, Phil offers some incredible insights into, you know, the rise of, you know, white nationalist movements and racism and fascism, and sort of offer some interesting counterpoints to that. And I'm not going to blab on and on about this book. I really love this book. And just an aside, I had become introduced to Phil's work years ago, and I didn't even know that this was the same person, but the song on Nihilismo, Generation Fucked, was a song that I wrote after reading an article he wrote for Ultra called Why Riot. And it was, you know, he just really talked about the sort of quote-unquote precariat in such a succinct way. So I'll play that song at the end of the podcast. One, you know, sort of addendum that I'll put in here is throughout this conversation, we're talking about... fuck the police. We're talking about mutual aid projects. And for folks who are interested in that conversation, I highly recommend people check out Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, who have been going all over the United States, giving trainings and not only that, but just doing the actual work on the ground in North Carolina and around the country as we've experienced these climate disasters. So check them out as well. And if you dig this podcast, you know, share it around on social media, blah, blah, blah. Subscribe, rate on iTunes. And if you want to support it through Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/SOLEONE. And before we get into this podcast, fuck the police. Now, before we get into this podcast, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
The border is not just a wall. It's not just a line on a map. It's a power structure, a system of control. The border does not divide one world from another. There is only one world, and the border is tearing it apart.
The Ex Worker Podcast presents No Wall They Can Build, a guide to borders and migration across North America. A serialized audiobook in 11 chapters released every Wednesday. Tune in at crimethink.com/podcast.
Phil Neal, welcome to the fucking Soulcast.
Thanks.
How you living?
Good. Yeah. Just working.
Hope you're not working too hard. Is it a dreary mist in Seattle right now?
No, it's actually a very nice early spring for the past couple weeks. We got that, like, you know how it got like super hot in Alaska, kind of at the time that the big flood was happening in Nebraska. And we got that heat wave over here too. And so it got like very hot a couple weeks ago, chilled down a little bit, and now it's like hot again. Nice sunny day.
Nice. Well, it's so funny because like
on one hand, it's like great to ask people on a podcast or whatever, in a conversation, like, what's the weather, as like a you know, icebreaker or whatever. But really, it's a political question now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I find it's a very useful writing technique, is when I can't think of how to introduce the thing, I talk about the weather, and then it becomes immediately political. So
that's awesome. You have this book out, Hinterland. How long has it been out?
It's a little bit different. It released in the UK first, but it's been out about a year, that I think it came out in the UK and EU about a year ago, and then a little bit later in the US.
It's a cool book. I'm a slow reader, so probably would have taken me a year to read it if I got the UK version. But this book is really incredible. And what's so cool is that it, not just the subject matter, but, like, you know, the style of, like, it's a combination of, like, what I would say prose and history and personal narratives and political analysis. And so, like, that combination makes it, like, a really fun read, because you don't just start tuning out from like academic jargon.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about, just in general, like why you wrote the book and why you wrote it in this style?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of reasons I kind of wrote it in general. I wanted to tackle the subject matter. I think a big impetus for writing it in general was actually just getting, being kind of involved with political stuff and the kind of general like leftist scene for a while, and kind of constantly running into this issue of people who not only did not really have a clear understanding of kind of the basic political and economic geography of the country, especially when it comes to what we would think of as like rural places, but often didn't even have an understanding of those basic questions in the city that they were living in, and would misperceive like very fundamental dynamics of those cities, even though they were there and they could go and look at these places themselves. So would, like, for example, would focus almost exclusively on these, you know, handful of the traditional kind of organizing neighborhoods in the central city or whatever, which essentially means that you're focusing most of your political time on like gentrification and that sort of thing. But then not really asking the associated question of like, well, if we've seen this massive demographic change in these neighborhoods in the urban core, where is everyone going to? And they really, you know, weren't exploring that or weren't aware of kind of how a lot of these cities were even structured. And then I think a lot of people for that reason, were kind of caught off guard when something like Ferguson happened, in the sense that it happened, in a suburb and not in one of the neighborhoods that they kind of assumed it would have happened in. And I think a lot of people actually saw it from a distance as if it did happen kind of in inner city St. Louis or something. And really haven't fully made the connection of that there's something kind of qualitatively different going on with the geography of unrest here. But so that was a big impulse to kind of write out the content of the book in some fashion. Just people kind of running into this problem of kind of poor cognitive mapping of politics and economics in the U.S. today. As for the style, I think it's just like a long time ago, I wrote a lot more fiction and that sort of thing, and was kind of trained in it. I got an undergrad degree in writing, and then did not really want to pursue it as a thing anymore, but used those skills kind of in this respect to make something that I just think is like more readable, it attaches all this academic kind of thinking to it, but in a more digestible way, and in a way that's really not aimed at like getting success through academic publishers or kind of building up an academic resume. I have some academic things I wrote, but I generally write for just a broad audience if I can. There's always issues of taste that kind of limit that, but the basic idea is just writing in a way that's fairly accessible, even if parts of it are difficult, and then writing kind of for much more general audience that isn't going to maybe like know what neoliberalism means, you know?
Well, yeah. And another thing that, like, you know, in a lot of this kind of stuff, it's like, we're told to like take ourselves out of it. But it seems like, you know, where you grew up in Northern California, you know, played like a definitive role in this analysis, right?
Yeah. And it's, I think it's a difficult thing when we're talking about authorship and talking about political stuff, because on the one hand, there's this kind of attempt at kind of objectivity or whatever, of stepping back and just kind of looking at the data and just kind of trying to talk these very neutral terms. On the other hand, there's kind of a hyper identity it's encouraged in a lot of academic writing and in political writing, especially, where you're really not supposed to talk about anything immediately, like outside the immediate bounds of your experience. And so it's kind of a attempt to kind of balance these two things, which I think are both wrong. Like, you can talk about stuff that's outside the bounds of your immediate experience, but you have to talk about them in a way that doesn't make it sound like it's your immediate experience. And there's a lot of stuff that's going to be, there's definitely experience it's going to be kind of beyond the bounds of what you can talk about. And you have to be careful, like, that you don't go into that line and be very like explicitly speaking for someone else or whatever. But I think that using my own kind of the area that I'm from, that was a good kind of route to navigate between those two things. And I did it in a way that I hope was somewhat successful in trying to look at kind of the universal aspects of individual experience, which I think is a more classical, you know, like a classical communist way of writing and thinking about things. So trying to look at those commonalities in the experience of class and work and space, and how these geographies kind of get replicated in different, in wildly different cultural contexts. But you can kind of communicate with people in the same ways because you have a lot of that same fundamental experience.
Yeah, you know, one person's exploding meth lab around the corner is, you know, someone else's, you know, bursting pipeline, or, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I was actually very surprised to, I guess initially surprised, but then very quickly was kind of had the thought of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. When I went to China for the first time and I was kind of asking people what like the drugs were that people did in China. And everyone's like, oh, well, like meth and ketamine. And I'm like, oh, well, that's pretty much exactly the same as like Southern Oregon, you know?
Yeah. I mean, again, like part of there's so many things to talk about here, but it's like, you know, I like how you opened it up from talking about being in China, because it, like, you know, later on through the book, you know, talking about like the logistics city and all that stuff, it kind of like, you know, living in Seattle, you start to see like these direct connections. But yeah, can you talk about what you learned from your time you spent in China? Because not a lot of people get to go to China.
Yeah. I mean, it was the reason that I opened with that is because I really did want to emphasize the kind of global nature of what I'm talking about. Because I know that writing a book kind of like this, structured like this, and with like the cover that the publisher chose, the impetus is to really kind of portray it as like a story of like the American Rust Belt or something, which is definitely not what it's intended as. So opening kind of with this global story, I think, emphasizes that this is like a global thing. And that it also is something that's valid, not just in what we might think of as kind of a post-industrial setting, but is even valid in places where that we think of as hyper-industrial. I think that's kind of a misconception about China. But yeah. So from living in China and doing some slightly more academic kind of work there and just kind of language training and stuff like that. You know, I ended up, so I lived in Southwest China for a bit when I really did not speak very much Chinese at that time. I was just learning. I lived in Yunnan province, I spent longer time in the Pearl River Delta area, in Guangzhou for a summer, and then in Shenzhen for a summer. And that's right across from like Hong Kong. And it's basically part of what most people think of as kind of like the factory of the world. It's more distributed than that kind of realistically, but it is a huge, huge center for, global manufacturing production. Still there's been some significant changes, in recent years, but basically it's like where they make the iPhones. Like I you know, could walk and see the factory where they were making the iPhones. So one thing that kind of informs is this in China, you have this very, very recent type of capitalist urbanization. And so it really does give some insight into the pattern of urbanization as dictated kind of by the logic of a capitalist economy. People think it's like hyper-regulated or whatever, but that's really just not the case. Like there's, especially when we're talking about like industrial development and early industrial kind of geographies in places like the Pearl River Delta, a lot of that was dictated just by like local officials who are essentially turned these little county slash village governments into things kind of like shareholder corporations. So it's as if like your little village became kind of a shareholder corporation. You were bidding against other villages to attract industrial sites.
Jesus.
And you would build, you know, roads and stuff like that. And basically getting very, very little, essentially no monetary support from the central government for any of that, using the foreign exchange that you got from these factories in order to build new resources and stuff. And then you would pay out money to all the legal villagers in the township or whatever it was. And at that point, a large portion of the actual population would have been migrant workers from the countryside who were not villagers in that village and therefore did not get those kind of same benefits. But this is kind of the story of how a lot of people who got some wealth in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s in the Pearl River Delta, maybe had family in Hong Kong and they used those links to open these kind of factories. But the point for looking at this kind of question of like where the urbanization happens and what these industrial hinterlands look like, is basically that this gives us a very good picture of kind of a purely capitalist process of urbanization. I would say like the Western cities of the U.S., and these mega cities in China, and you could also kind of argue in other parts of East Asia, and then today in East Africa and maybe South Asia, they give a very good picture because they aren't really muddied by older urban forms. Like if you look at cities in Europe, like, you know, they kind of build up, a lot of them build up around these kind of medieval towns, and kind of older cities like Rome or whatever. And so you kind of have an added variable historically, but in like the Western cities in the U.S., you just kind of have cities completely founded by market logic. And then the same thing kind of in China now as kind of a live version of that historical process, that occurred, that founded kind of the big Western cities, here. And so what you see is you see generally this kind of sprawling type of urban development with, that has like a bunch of little cores. But if you try to find like the downtown of a city like Shenzhen, it's like very difficult. Like there's several different downtown cores all kind of trying to vie as if they are the central core. And you know, it's very similar to a place like Houston, which I think I make this comparison in the book, is that like, if you compare like Houston, to like Shenzhen, like that's your kind of like two great case studies in how capitalist urbanization works, and how these kind of industrial hinterlands are kind of created around small cores of kind of capital accumulation centers that are like little financial cores or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way you describe the Chinese, expansion I had just spoken with Jasper Burns a couple episodes back, and we were talking about Marx's or the belly of the revolution, and about like Marx's ideas about like cities. We're gonna have to get rid of cities and have like a blending of something of like rural and urban in order to like have like sustainable agriculture. And it seems like they read Marx out there, and seems like that's from what you described. It seems kind of similar to that. Like, so for, in my mind, I was thinking, oh, that's an interesting revolutionary strategy to build, you know, these sort of, you know, whatever communes, you know, places outside of cities that are, you know, a blending of rural and city. But then it seems like they're doing that right now in China. And so it's like, God, you know, they've thought of everything.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think it's just more a normal type of capitalist urbanization than we think of it. It's just that the scale is kind of different. And so it's, you can see it a bit more clearly when it happens at this scale, because you still kind of have kind of far off rural areas, and you still have to have massive amounts of external food production to satisfy these sprawling urban centers, even though you can also have some food production intermixed in it. I mean, the debate that Jasper brings up, like, I'm writing something very slowly that's kind of a loose engagement with his Belly of the Revolution piece. I just think that the problem right now is that the data used in these kind of arguments is very poor or basically non-existent about how current agricultural systems kind of work. It doesn't really get linked into these kind of debates. And so they become kind of very abstract conceptual debates about things that Marx was kind of saying based on observing a very limited type of European capitalist urbanization that was, again, kind of very deeply connected to kind of this medieval town structure and wasn't paying as much attention to how cities were developing, like the American West, and what this kind of sprawling urbanization means. And then also needing to be attentive to what food production systems actually look like today, and kind of reimagining this idea of breaking down the urban and the rural. I think it's a good idea, but I think that it doesn't look like what we would imagine it to look like small communes attached to the land, or something like that. I think it looks like something that is harder to recognize, you know, and that needs to be kind of actually conceptualized.
Yeah, totally. It's hard to grow all your own food.
Yeah, that's the main thing is I think that a lot of people write about this stuff. And I don't mean to sound like denigrating to like Jasper personally or whatever, even if we have theoretical disagreements, but I do think it is important when writing about like agricultural stuff. This is like I guess a very classical Marxist position in some ways, is that like, it's important that you have farmed, you know, that you know kind of what's entailed in farm work and in agricultural production, because I think that people, when they write about it from a distance, it just kind of, you know, it sucks to farm. Like, I've worked on farms like a lot of my life, and it is not fun, you know. Like, there's parts of it that are good. It's nice to but I think the parts of it that are good are more similar to kind of like gardening, you know, but like the long days under the sun doing agricultural labor is like not great. And so I think that any kind of communist strategy that emphasizes like that would require a lot of people to go back to the land and commit long hours to farming, you know, that's not something that I think is going to be super popular. But I also think it's a very important thing to kind of have some of that experience to understand that, like that question that you brought up, like it's really hard to grow a lot of your own food. Like the actual amounts of land that are required for food production, especially when you're trying to do it in a way that's like much more sustainable and like build up the soil structure and things like that. It's like a ton of land. Like it's a lot of land. It's a lot of labor. And so it kind of raises some different issues that I don't think get adequately addressed with proper kind of like data at the large scale, but also data at that small scale of like experience as, you know, a farmer and looking at various farming projects and kind of seeing how they fail consistently. I think that's a huge thing that people don't realize in the U.S. is that farming is not like that successful for the most part. It's very much this weird industry that's built up by government subsidies. It's a, like a massive kind of state state involved like network that really is only successful at these like very large scales. Like this kind of myth of the small American farmer, you know, it's very, they're not self-sustaining in almost ever any respect in most cases, whether we think of that as self-sustaining in the sense of being able to grow their own, like their own food and their own community's food, or in like the capitalist sense of like being solvent, like neither of those are true, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I'm very into permaculture. I'm kind of like, you know, part of why I was drawn to your book is because I moved out to Maine, you know, the hinterlands of Maine to, you know, buy a farm and do a permaculture food forest. And so I'm trying to like, you know, I don't know, I'm trying to do it, but also like whittling it down so that it's like manageable because I don't want to be toiling out in the sun. So it's, again, it's a question because I'm vegan and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, you know, there's a whole bunch of other things that make it more complicated, but it's a it's a worthwhile thing to explore and to work on. But
yeah, and it's good to have these general skills. Like I'm glad that I have skills in you know, farming and composting and soil, like they in rehabilitating soil and things like that. They're useful, but I think that it's also something that in that area that I'm from, it's kind of an interesting kind of situation because you have a lot of people who went and tried to do this back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And they all like it just universally kind of failed in different ways. All these land projects and things like that. I kind of grew up in the ruins of these land projects and people either became like they had to pivot into becoming big growers in the early kind of marijuana industry. And that was all like a big foundation of that in Northern California and Southern Oregon were all these back to the land hippies. Others became kind of weird mountain libertarians. others became very conservative, like basically just became conservative, you know, farming and ranching families. And then many just kind of moved back to that. The cities, of course. But I kind of grew up in kind of the ruins of that. And so, was very much kind of attentive to, I think these political questions that kind of go beyond that, or how do you link that back to the urban cores? How do we, make it so that it's not kind of a running away from the urban cores type of thing. But you also realize like, this last summer I was doing, some language training stuff in Tanzania. And you know, this is one of those places where you still have pretty robust, like, local food systems operational, and they're pretty, like, they're significantly better in terms of like retaining soil structure, doing like kind of food forest style, like harvesting and tending, and you know, massive amounts of available kind of compost material that gets fed back into the agricultural system. But you also start to realize like how large of, how much that has to operate at scale as well. Like it's hard to do it locally because you're not really surrounded by, all of these resources that are kind of taken for granted in those settings, like having access to a lot of, animal manure, for example, or just not having, basically, like this rapid process of desertification, like at the edge of your property holding, you know, because the people next to you are also practicing good kind of soil, soil tending, agriculture, you know? So those things, you do kind of realize how much scale that also requires, even these kind of permaculture systems, when they operate at larger scales, you can see kind of benefits to them, but yeah.
Yeah, and the only other thing I would tack on to that is just like as you were, you know, just as a you're a logistics man, the you know a lot of soil that people use to like start seeds has perlite in it, and perlite only comes from volcanoes, and yeah. And you know, to tack on to what you were saying about you know, a lot of farms, even like the local, the mythical local organic farmer, not being solvent. Like they're reliant largely, a lot of them, on grants for, you know, whatever, some experimental farming thing, or like using NGO models. And a lot of them can't function at all without like as many interns as there are paid employees, or, you know, or more interns, you know. And that's,
yeah,
that's fucking, that's, that feels really exploitive. I mean, that is exploitive.
Oh yeah. I've worked as a free volunteer on many organic farm in exchange for like food and housing. It's, you know, it's not, it's the conclusion is basic, is pretty simple. It's just that it's not that fun to be a peasant, you know?
That's so funny. I'm it's hilarious that we ended up talking about food. Well, you know, again, like, I know your book isn't about this, but this guy was elected president who speaks for all working class American people, named Donald Trump. And, you know, I feel like your book really kind of shatters a lot of myths about, quote unquote, Trump country. So can you sort of speak on, you know, some of your takes or takeaways about Trump country?
Yeah. So this is interesting because the vast majority of the book was written before Trump got elected. And then I had to go do like a very brief rewrite of one of the chapters. It wasn't even really a rewrite. It was just like adding in a few paragraphs that was specifically like tacked on, like, oh, yeah, and Trump got elected type stuff, you know. But the vast majority was written before Trump got elected. And so it was just describing these kind of trends. And part of the book afterwards, I'm kind of glad that I have it to kind of reference for people, because I, you know, you do get in these discussions where people talk about the rural U.S. As if it universally kind of was Trump country, voted for Trump, but also just kind of the rural U.S. as if it is like this, you know, exclusively white space and things like that, which is very wrong. I mean, it's very localized and it's very regionally dependent. You know, like the Northeast is pretty, it kind of follows that model in a more, in the sense that a lot of it is actually more exurban. I would say that actually Maine is one of the only parts of the Northeast that really has like a properly kind of rural wing to it. A lot of the other parts of the Northeast kind of rural areas are actually kind of exurbs. But if you look at like a state like New Mexico, for instance, like I have family in New Mexico, and so I'm there, you know, somewhat often. And New Mexico is – the rural New Mexico is only about 30% white. But, you know, this is a state with a huge amount of rural population. I mean, like, it's a very rural state by comparison, but it's not kind of what people think of when they think of rural America. But it de facto kind of is, you know, a very important part of rural America, especially when we're talking about rural poverty. Like New Mexico has, severe problems with all of the things that we associate with rural poverty, and, like from opioid crisis to just general issues of rural poverty. And then we talk about like South Dakotans and things like that. And then we're starting to talk also about places like Pine Ridge and these areas that are, we're seeing now after this flood, are substantially like not receiving the same amount of support as these other parts of the rural state that have been essentially washed away. So what all of that kind of just means is this picture of rural America that people have as attached to a figure like Trump is just very wrong in many respects. It's also wrong in a very concrete electoral aspect when people say that rural states and rural counties and stuff predominantly voted for Trump. What is actually going on is that, like in any poor area in the United States, poor people generally do not vote. So the bulk of the voting age population either cannot or does not vote. They cannot vote because we live in a country where you get stripped of your voting rights if you have a felony. And that means we also live in a country where, like, if you punch a cop, you can't vote.
You wouldn't know anything about that.
We also have, you know, a lot of people who are disenfranchised in other ways, whether it be that they're just like undocumented or don't have
like the kind of institutional access to like get to voting, voting places and things like that. On top of that, you have people who just, of course, don't vote because they don't see anyone to vote for. There's no one who speaks to their interests, and politicians are basically all the same. And that's the perception and the thing that you hear again and again when you actually go and talk to people in these places. Then what happens? So why do these places appear as like these giant swaths of red on these election maps? It's because the people who do vote in these places are attached to the political patronage structures that do exist in many of these counties. And in rural counties, the only political patronage structure that really exists is the patronage structure of the Republican Party, because they have this particular connection with the landowners, the petty capitalists in those areas. And that involves essentially just signing checks for these subsidies for the most part. But it also involves things like making sure that environmental regulations aren't that strictly enforced or infringing on their business or whatever. So if you look at what these areas are structured like politically, you know, the reason that the votes that are happening are going to the Republican Party is because the Republican Party is kind of the only game in town. And a lot of that is because the Democrats simply don't have any kind of plan for these areas, because the Democrats are much more overtly about kind of defending capital accumulation in its centers in the big cities, and don't really have any need to go to these places to garner votes for that effort. And these places are essentially economic sacrifice zones in many respects. The Republican Party uses them very skillfully to maintain a disproportionate level of support in U.S. politics because of how the Electoral College is structured, and because of how they can kind of mobilize this patronage, this leftover kind of patronage structure in these areas. But that patronage structure is not representative of all the people living in these rural spaces. Many of those people, if you talk to them, they just hate both parties, you know, as pretty much any poor person in the U.S. does, because they see them as essentially producing the same results again and again and again.
Yeah, I haven't met a single Trump Well, no, my mother's boyfriend, actually. But he, you know, whatever. He helps out a lot, so he helps me chop down trees. So, and he won't vote for him next time. But for the most part, like, you go out and you just talk to normal people who you would think voted for Trump, and they're, like, you know, open to, you know, anarchist politics or communism, mm-hmm. as you would say, or, you know. And it's, you know, it is just like you say. Yeah, it reminded me when I was living in Denver, like, you know, I'd be in Boulder and I'd be like, oh, Boulder's so white. And then people would say, Boulder's not that fucking white. It's just all the people of color are made invisible here. And other statistics that I thought were interesting. And again, it's just like this nuance that sort of like challenges these sort of, you know, activist ideas about identity and privilege or whatever. You know, like the... like talking about white women as being one of the more incarcerated people in the United States, what is it exactly you said about white women in incarceration?
Like, it's just that they're the fastest growing population being incarcerated, like the fastest growing demographic in terms of the incarceration rate. So, and the reason that they're fastest growing is because they started out, you know, much smaller population. But it's that they're the fastest growth in U.S. incarceration is among women, and then among white women, it's like much higher than it has been historically. But a lot of that is because that was very low historically.
But also, you know, like the basic belief that, like, you know, the inner city ghettos, or however people would say it, where like poverty is the worst, but actually, you know, black poverty is way worse in rural areas. And
like the Mississippi River Delta. I think if you look at like Kelly Yacuno and the Jackson Kush kind of plan, Cooperation Jackson, like they bring attention to that, and they have, I think, a lot more detailed data about that kind of phenomenon. But they're definitely not like the image of like organizing among the kind of poor black population in the U.S. is still very much this image of like inner city organizing, you know?
Right. And I've been wanting to learn a lot more about that project. It seems really fucking interesting. Do you know those people?
I have met them a little bit. I kind of ironically met somebody who was somewhat like affiliated with similar stuff in Tanzania, from an old that has like a land project there or whatever. Old Panthers who settled went there after getting to flee the crackdown in the U.S. and flee COINTELPRO. But no, I'm not super. Like I've never been down there. I'm not super involved. I just know it's one of the more interesting kind of political things that's going on in the sense of when you look at areas where people are generally not organizing. There's very few cases I can think of where people are trying to do more organizing in these areas that are kind of these economic sacrifice zones. A lot of the organizing in the U.S. of course happens in the cores of these kind of creative class cities. And then the stuff that happens in rural areas, it is kind of just a lot of, people with kind of vague politics, maybe doing some sort of organic farm thing. But that quickly becomes kind of a dependence on grants and these free volunteers. So it is one of the few cases where people are doing organizing kind of at a large scale and articulating it well and making it very visible. In some of these areas and where there is a concrete kind of strategy, whether or not you agree with it, and the exact role of electoral politics in it. I think that Kelly Acuno has done like good, like a good appraisal of the problems of the electoral side of it. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting project. I don't know. I'm not personally as engaged with it, obviously, because I'm out here, but yeah.
Yeah. This term. Yeah. I was just like, I guess that's an aside. I was just like, it keeps coming up and I'm like, God, I don't know shit about this project. So like there are terms in your book that, that I'd never really heard before. And I think they're useful terms. So I was just wondering if you could just talk about it a little bit, like what is the exurbs?
Oh yeah.
Lay out your geography of the hinterlands real quick, you know, just to give people.
Yeah. So, okay. We've got these. So if we take, cities, like the kind of the prototypical city, I think of where a lot of American cities are going, are places like Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Atlanta. You can also look at some of the new South cities. So we could think of kind of areas in like the Carolina Research Triangle. These sort of cities, what you see is this urban core that kind of tends to focus a lot of things that kind of traditionally have been called producer services. But it's just kind of, you know, some of it's like high tech, like tech companies with headquarters or whatever. A lot of it is actually just kind of like legal services, the kind of headquarters style function, like administrative functions for companies. And those things have a certain logic to why they aggregate in this way. There's this whole literature called like the global cities literature, Saskia Sassen and other people who have written about it. But those areas, even though they become very much the focus of a lot of organizing and the focus of a lot of attention, when we talk about like how the economy gets portrayed, these are portrayed as like the big productive hubs. But really partially that's just like a artifact of how we gather economic statistics. It's kind of a replication of the GDP problem that exists at the global scale of like if you have a company like Apple, for example, like I could go and talk to Foxconn workers who are making the Apple phones. But the way that value chain gets calculated, basically the entire value chain gets calculated as belonging to Apple as an American company and not belonging to Foxconn as a Taiwanese contractor or any of their kind of subcontractors within mainland China. So basically what happens in the U.S. kind of context is that you see these kind of inflated numbers about the economic output of these downtown cores that are based on the fact that there's just these kind of the end of those value chains kind of lies there in these headquarters or in these kind of high value producer services. But if you go just kind of outside those kind of urban cores, basically what I think of as the gentrification line, like where the gentrification line ends is usually kind of where you can think of as like the wall is. And it's very frequently kind of around the administrative borders of these cities. But what that means is if you look at demographic statistics, all the things that kind of that you would associate with gentrification, of course, are like increase in the number of people with high with like postgraduate degrees in an area, the number of people with higher incomes, a greater share of white population, not just the greater share of white population though, also greater shares of specific kind of specific visa categories, like the high end tech worker visas, for example, because there's definitely some areas in Seattle, and also if you look at cities in like Atlanta, where gentrification occurs, but it doesn't have as clear of a like white racial dynamic. Like Bellevue in Seattle is a very diverse city, but if you look at like the economic statistics about income, it's not diverse in any sense, like by income. So if you look at where those patterns kind of flip, what you generally see in these cities is you see a lot of these areas in the urban core that are rapidly gentrifying, of course, like historically black neighborhoods becoming majority white. A lot of them gentrifying to these kind of light diversity kind of settings where they all have kind of high income, but it's not exclusively white. As you go farther from that urban core, you see the same pattern, but it begins to diminish a little bit. And maybe there's some neighborhoods that are kind of retaining their older character or whatever. But over decades, they begin to be kind of eroded. But what you then hit eventually is the place where everyone is going. And this is the place where people who have to move out of the city go. This is also the place where new migrants, both from the U.S. and internationally, tend to settle in many of these cities. And those are the traditional inner ring suburbs or the fringe of the old urban administrative boundary. And so in Seattle, that's kind of these areas kind of around the SeaTac Airport and going down into the Kent Valley, going over into Burien, and then going kind of southward toward Tacoma. And what you did... the way that you can identify these kind of in the numbers is because it's where you begin to see the opposite trends. These are places that were predominantly white suburbs or predominantly wealthier upper middle class suburbs. And they're the areas where if you map out the same data over 20 years, say, you see the opposite trend. You see a massive decrease in the white population, massive decrease in the higher income population. You see substantial increases in the foreign-born population, and new migrants from other parts of the U.S., in people without postgraduate degrees, and with just kind of generally it's like hyper-diversity in some cities that have more of like a white-black kind of demographic profile. You see just a shift, and so that's what you see in like Ferguson. It used to be a predominantly white suburb, and then it shifts from like two-thirds white to two-thirds black over the course of about like 15 years. But in cities like Seattle, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and then like the Bay Area, you see these logistics kind of suburbs, and I'll get to the logistics part in a second, but these logistics suburbs, they are frequently like hyper diverse. So it's people from like all over, like some of the areas around here have, I think, set records for the highest number of languages spoken in the school districts. I think there was one that was like in excess of 100 languages spoken in one of the school districts in like Renton or something. So those areas are kind of what I call the near hinterland, these inner ring suburbs. And they act as kind of a disavowed core of the economy, because what's going on in these areas, especially in the more kind of
economically successful cities like Seattle, there's these huge kind of new industrial clusters that have been developing in these areas that are focused on what we would think of as kind of the logistics kind of industry broadly. So it's a lot of warehousing, utilities, it's some wholesale trade centers, and then it's stuff like ports, rail yards. They also mix in retail linkages frequently. So you'll have like outlet kind of mall stuff, but they're very close to the actual warehouses. And then on top of that, you have kind of this other side of logistics, which is like the waste side of logistics. So you have recycling centers, waste processing and transit kind of facilities. Those industries are more prominent in the less economically successful kind of cities. You'll see a lot higher portions of that sort of waste logistics type of work. And then you see a few places that act as kind of like super hubs where that kind of logistical logic kind of takes over. And so Memphis is one in terms of employment. And then the other one, like another one is like, I think Lexington, Kentucky. I might be getting that wrong. Or Louisville. Yeah, anyways, these are kind of super hubs for FedEx and UPS in terms of their air transit. So you have these inner ring suburbs that kind of look like that. They have this new logistics employment. You're starting to see the beginning of kind of organizing in some places like Amazon fulfillment centers. But it's very much this hyper diverse kind of new logistics style kind of working class thing. There's some other dynamics, which I could come back to later, about like how the police operate in these areas and whatnot. But if we go so just to kind of reiterate what this geography looks like, we have this urban core, we have this tight ring around the urban core of this kind of logistics suburb that I call the near hinterland. That begins to phase out as you go farther from the city into what are called exurbs normally. And the exurb is essentially these small towns, more or less. They're kind of suburbs, but really kind of not, because they're so far from the urban center. They're at about the end of what's called like the urban tether, which is more or less like a measure of can you commute pretty easily to the urban, like into the kind of the urban area. And these exurbs are very interesting because they're the only places in the U.S. where you still see those very classic kind of patterns of white flight, where you have these areas are becoming more white, and they're not becoming more white in the sense of like the gentrifying neighborhoods where they kind of top out at this like light diversity, where you'll have like it's still kind of majority white, but it's pretty diverse in general, especially in like during like the working day. But even in terms of like residents, it's still pretty diverse. It's definitely not exclusively white. But these exurbs come much closer to like something that's a much more exclusively like white space in the U.S. They tend to be wealthier than the kind of near hinterland suburbs of like inner ring logistics city suburbs. People tend to kind of own more. It's more kind of homeowner kind of based in many respects. And you also see kind of the employment structure there is slightly different. There's definitely like overlap with both the near hinterland kind of poverty, people working in these logistics centers. There's also overlap with kind of the rural poverty beyond it. But a lot of people end up working on these kind of weird niches within the urban structure. So they work in some part of kind of the vast, what is essentially a vast like American style welfare structure of the construction industry, which is like really interesting when you look at in terms of economic statistics. It's like it's sorely unproductive compared to other industries, but also compared to like globally. It's wildly inefficient, the U.S. construction industry, and it's hugely bureaucratic. So it's very much kind of like the, if you want to look for like the U.S. welfare state, I would say like the welfare state with American characteristics is like the construction industry. You see people working in all kind of segments of like construction. So they're like some sort of vague, you know, contractor or whatever. Or they work in the enforcement of kind of just the state in various respects. So they work
as prison guards, or they work as police officers in like patrolling these inner ring suburbs or in the actual cities. They will frequently work in some kind of other respect. So you see a lot of, like, military will sometimes like settle down in these areas because they do tend to also be close to military bases in many cities. And you will see people who, if you look at like the southwestern exurbs, the like where do ICE agents live? You know, you're going to see like a good segment in these kind of exurbs in the southwest as well. The exurbs are interesting also because some are very wealthy. Some are kind of like country club cities. And the exurbs are actually one of the only places in the U.S. where you do see very high levels of voter participation and that voter participation going to Trump. So that is really, if you want to identify where Trump country is, like look for these specific like exurbs where you have a bunch of like contractors and police officers living.
Jesus. You had like pretty much described where I was living with your exurbs. And then, but we have a college here, so it's actually,
oh yeah. So some will be college towns too. That's a good caveat. Some will have a very specific industry that they settle around. So college towns, the other ones are like ones that have some sort of big federal employment, in terms of like conservation, something like a Forest Service site or something like that.
Here it's just a bunch of liberals who hate the working class. As I was reading your thing on the excerpts in your book, I was recalling like one of the 3 percenter cops who killed this man, Paul Castaway, who literally lived in one of those places, and we were going to go do a house demo at his house. And then we decided against it because we're like, someone's probably going to get killed if we show up on this guy's lawn. But one of the things I really liked in your book, or one of the many things I liked, when you were talking about like the role that 3 percenters played in Nevada, can you talk about your take on 3 percenters and what they were doing in Nevada, and maybe like what radicals in rural more rural areas can take away from that?
So I focus on 3 percenters for a few reasons. I mean, I really focus kind of more generally just on the militia movement at that stage in time, which is like the Obama kind of era militia movement. Militia movements in the U.S. tend to reach their peaks under Democratic administrations, and then they fall they don't completely go away, but they fall out of popularity under Republicans because they don't have a super easy federal government kind of target. So that's something to keep in mind, is that when we're talking about kind of 3 percenters then and the militia movement then, it's not necessarily has the same character as it does like at the exact moment right now, because it's definitely fallen off in terms of participation. When it falls off in terms of participation, you see these idiotic things like Patriot Prayer and whatnot like start to take on the garb of it. But the actual participation numbers are much lower than they were during the all these standoffs, and not just like the wildlife refuge standoff, but also like this thing that happened on a mine in Oregon and Southern Oregon around near Grants Pass. So that's something to kind of keep in mind, is it sound like a lot of the elements of the militia movement are also more actively being kind of wrapped into a more consistently stupid far right kind of position now, that's also like less, like has less of a mass traction than the militia movement did under the Obama years. But I focus on that militia movement for a few reasons. First is just to kind of illustrate the type of politics that do kind of arise in these spaces, especially when they're kind of abandoned by any kind of nominally left-wing forces. The other thing, though, is to kind of illustrate a few trends that are kind of potentials for the far right in the U.S., but aren't they really weren't seized on fully by the militia movement, and they haven't been seized on fully since. But there's a few key trends in what was going on with the militia movement. And the first was the abandonment of these explicitly racist politics in favor of a good chunk of members having implicit kind of racist positions that aren't voiced in that way. And then another chunk of members really earnestly probably not being racist, but just being, you know, kind of vaguely right wing about stuff. And having more participation, like more earnestly multiracial participation or whatever, compared to previous generations of the militia movement, which has been very white and has been very much linked with kind of like white biker gang type structure of organizing. And so you saw more diversification, and it had to kind of recenter the way that it spoke about race because of that. And one of the ways that it did that is by emphasizing this kind of communitarian localist kind of politics in race neutral terms. And again, it wasn't truly race neutral in many respects, but the way that they kind of spoke of things was to emphasize this kind of communitarianism instead of kind of the racial grouping coded, however, you know. And so that's interesting for a few reasons. The first reason is that you could see it, you could, in the abstract, see something like that being replicated outside the far hinterland in other areas and in a more truly kind of multiracial setting. Because I think that the thing that doesn't really get recognized in the U.S. when we're talking about the future of the far right, there is an error that gets made. There's a couple errors that get made. One is that we think it should like have a historical kind of face, and so they should kind of look like Nazis or whatever. I think that's something a little bit more that like your kind of everyday liberal will sort of assume, and that's where like the alt-right gets all its purchase by saying, well, we're not like really Nazis, we're like white nationalists or something. It's like, okay, dude. But the other thing, the other error that gets made, I think, by people who are a little bit more aware of what's going on is that they look at what kind of the far right more or less looks like right now, and they think that that's what the far right will look at like in the future. And so, you know, it's guys with Punisher t-shirts driving big trucks or something, like white dudes.
Punisher t-shirts, God.
Yeah, but I think that that's also an error, right? Because one of the points I make in my book is that this organizing model, if we take the militia movement really as the most successful version of it, which I think it has been in terms of actual participation and just general kind of support, it's been the most successful in the sense that it almost kind of had a mass character. It didn't get as much spectacular media coverage as the alt-right, but when you're talking about political movements, I think we really have to measure them much more in terms of their potential to become kind of a mass movement of some sort and have mass participation rather than their adoption into kind of this media apparatus. So if we look at it in those terms, generally this far right organizing model kind of failed, and it did surprisingly bad in some respects. Like if you take as a given the idea that like rural America is Trump country and everyone's like racist and shit, then it does not make sense like the poor performance of some of the militia movement in some of these areas. Like it should have been much more successful than it was, and other kind of forms of racist politics should have been much more successful than they were. And the reason that they aren't, right, is because that is kind of a myth. Like people aren't just like racist hillbilly idiots like out in the country, you know. But the other thing,
I'm sorry to cut you off, but yeah. I really love that point in your book, and I'm so glad you just brought that back up because that was something I'd forgotten. But anyway, sorry.
Keep going. It's an important point to emphasize because I think that people kind of think of it in those terms, but it just doesn't make sense. Like there should already be a far right mass movement of actual mass character in the U.S. if that were the case, and the fact that that isn't true. Signals that there is other organizing potentials, right? That there isn't a mass movement, but that doesn't mean that it's inherently going to tilt to the right. So when we think of the future of the far right in the U.S., it's not going to look like it does right now. It's not going to look like it historically. What is it going to look like? And the thing is, it has to, if you just look at the basic demographic facts of the U.S., any far right movement that gains a mass following and a mass kind of participation in the United States over the next several decades is going to be a multiracial movement. it's just like, it can't just be like old white people, you know, and it can't just be young white people either. If it's going to have this mass kind of character. And so you have to start to think about how a far right movement in the US could do that, right? Because in the US, it's been so historically dependent on basically purely operating through kind of white resentment and chauvinism, male chauvinism and all this. So how could it become like a mass movement without kind of changing kind of those aspects? And then how could it change those sort of aspects, you know, within the US kind of political context? So focusing on the militia movement was kind of a tool to talk about some of the ways that I think that's possible. And some of the aspects that were important are like this communitarian localist focus of where it's not even necessarily logic. It doesn't have any logical necessity that it has to be kind of racialized, even though the militia movement, it definitely kind of takes on that character still. But just this idea of kind of a localist communitarian kind of, we're going to, you know, protect our area and you guys keep out if you're outsiders, you know, in general. And then on top of that, the kind of political approach, the fundamental political approach of like the militia movement has been opposition to these like essentially like rents in the kind of economic terms. But you can think of it as like fees, fines, like just exorbitant costs that are just kind of levied on an area. And the interesting thing is in their context, that's largely viewed through the context of the federal government. But in other areas, you know, this is very familiar to people in terms of like literally their rent for an apartment or various kinds of other fees and fines that come through interaction with the state. Right. So like the role of fees and fines in the municipal government in like Ferguson just leads to these positions where people are kind of constantly being confronted with just extractive kind of mechanisms of the state. And so they're experiencing exploitation as like rent taking, like extractive rent taking. And on the one side, that looks like police fees and fines in Ferguson. On the other side, that looks like the federal government or kind of other various kind of agencies trying to just like take more in taxes and apply more fees, like apply like building permit laws that are constructed for like with LA in mind, but they try to apply them to like rural California where it doesn't make any sense, you know? And so that I think is one of the ways where we could imagine like the far right taking on kind of a mass character while not having its core still be this kind of white resentment, which isn't going to have just for purely demographic reasons, like it has to be reinvented if the far right is going to become like a mass movement type of threat in the US, which isn't to say that that politics isn't dangerous. Like obviously it very much is in these individual senses and in the sense of someone like Trump, but also like these lone wolf kind of attackers or whatever. There's still plenty of badness affiliated with that kind of politics and bad results that come from it. And there's violence that comes from it and stuff like that. But I think it's an error to imagine that that's what the far right is going to look like in the future. And that risks missing kind of the growth of what might be a future kind of mass movement far right. So that's really why I focus on the militia movement. The other thing is just to emphasize kind of some of those potentials that exist, in some of these kind of sacrifice zones. Like it's not coincidental that the militia movement was doing most successfully in areas where it did provide like mutual aid, disaster response stuff, where it took over like patrols, where like the sheriffs had been like understaffed and essentially like abandoned areas. And so you had people who were just living out on their own and were like if they were in danger, especially from, and this is especially an issue in Southern Oregon, where people who had like maybe like a restraining order against an abusive spouse or something, you know, and they're living out in the country and then that person shows up and they don't have anyone to call. Like it became kind of a thing to the militia is offering itself as like, oh, well, you can call us, you know. Those sort of things kind of speak to a structural openings in these areas where any kind of organizing in areas like that is going to involve, you know, tasks of that sort. So it's going to involve things like disaster preparedness and disaster response. I think this is clear from what's been happening in the past few weeks with these floods. And that sort of thing is really not emphasized in this kind of leftist activist organizing kind of space, which is very much geared toward the, yeah, like I said, like these urban cores or whatever, and has very little, maybe the closest thing to it, would be something like the, you know, border support teams who are going and putting water out for people or whatever. But the logistical kind of capacity is much lower. And part of that is also just because a lot of the people who get involved in these kind of leftist activist spaces end up living around like college towns, or these urban kind of creative cores. So they just don't, you know, live out there.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, another thing you talk about in your book is how when you're, you know, part of the, you know, whatever, the hinterlands of rural areas, it's like, you know, you only have enough money to take your car to live in some other shitty town. Like the walls of entry to move to Seattle, you know, to come up with the $5,000 to get an apartment or whatever is, it's really high. And like one thing that blows my mind about living in Maine is like, you know, spending $500 a month to heat your house or, you know, food, things that I always took for granted, like ATM fees here are $3, yet everywhere else they're $2. And, you know, a head of non-organic romaine lettuce is $3 or $4, but at the grocery store in Denver, that organic head was $1.50. There's very little reason for it. Like Amazon's shipping that shit through Whole Foods or whoever. And like, we're only, you know, an hour and a half from Boston. Like it shouldn't be, you know, 50 to 100% more expensive to get, like my wife is buying, the vitamins when you're pregnant, prenatal vitamins. And they're like $30 more here. And it's like, that's just in a fucking thing. It costs $1 to mail it. Like what the fuck? And it's just like these, because these places are kind of impoverished, there is this extractive, like people are just taxing everyone in these spaces. And that's why everybody's fucking pissed off.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah. It's especially areas that are really out of the way. Like I remember buying a bag of Doritos in Wichipec, which is like right in between the Hoopa and the Yurok Reservation in California. And it's like down, you know, this highway that no one goes down. And I just remember being a kid, and this is back when like Doritos were like $1.50 or something. And it was like $5. And I was just like, oh, like those are really expensive Doritos. Like I was just thinking as a child, you know, but yeah, it's that kind of a phenomenon kind of writ large in a lot of costs in a lot of areas.
And 50% of Maine's population is on or under the poverty line. Like literally, I mean, that's just, that's fucked up. And so, yeah, that's when I was reading the stuff about the 3%ers, it just really made me, you know, think about these mutual aid programs differently and be like, huh, you know, it would take on a different character out here, but it seems, you know, because, you know, like you, I come out of Occupy and, you know, have seen the numerous failures of all these like struggles over the years. And just, I'm just, you know, like your experience of like coming back to town after you got, I don't know if it was when you got out of jail for your charges or whatever, you come back, all the reasonable people had left and there were only crazy, crazy people left. And, but like, so, you know, with all of this in mind, like what, I mean, I know it's a really hard and kind of bullshit question to ask, but like, what do you see as meaningful, you know, political activity for, you know, anti-authoritarians or quote unquote revolutionary thinkers or whatever, like what, like whether you're in a city or in a rural area, like what do you consider to be meaningful activity as far as like how people should be spending their time? It's really confusing under Trump.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also very, I think we have this strong tendency often when we talk about this sort of thing to this is something that I kind of jokingly kind of refer to as the Trotskyist syndrome, because of my many experiences having to interact with these, those little like weird newspaper selling Trotskyist sects. This was kind of before the era of like, SA actually, like Socialist Alternative actually holding seats in Seattle and like DSA and stuff like that. This was like back when they were like literally just selling newspapers, and it was like just kind of the worst people, and they didn't, they had like the DSA hadn't blown up and recruited like some normal people. But the syndrome is like being kind of in discussions with people like that or whatever, and being naive about it because I wasn't from the city and, you know, people didn't sell Trotskyist newspapers where I'm from. So I thought like, oh, I'll talk to this like nice socialist. And then having them just like, you know, grill you and berate you because you're not doing the exact same thing that they are doing, which they think is the one thing that everyone who believes in like revolution or whatever should be doing. Right. And it's not just a syndrome of like these people selling these you know elderly people selling newspapers. It's also something that you see when you interact with like a bunch of, you know, anarchy people or whatever, who are would do the same thing, but about like why aren't you like squatting? Like why aren't you doing this and this? This isn't that what everyone should be doing? It's this weird translation of like, I don't know, like the Kantian, like categorical imperative or something. But it's very bizarre to think about prescribing kind of politics in this way of like everyone who thinks that stuff is bad should be doing this one thing, right? Like this one weird trick. Really, I think that we have to ask this question in a much more embedded kind of way of like, well, like someone asked me like, well, you know, I read the book or whatever, and like, I'm interested in all this stuff, but like, I don't know what to like get involved in, you know, there's no prescriptive, there's no easy kind of prescriptive answer to that question, that the only real response is to first kind of actually figure out like, well, who are you? Like, what do you do? Like, where do you live? Like, what kind of area do you live in? What's going on in those sort of areas? And then on top of that, I think we also have to recognize that there's certain periods where there's not a lot going on necessarily, and you can't force things to happen because you want them to happen, you know. So sometimes engagement looks different than other times. Like when I think that, like while I think it's stupid to kind of like sit out when something like Occupy or the big kind of peak of Black Lives Matter protest was happening, like it's silly to sit out of those, you know. At the same time, it's equally silly to kind of pretend like they're both alive when they're not, or that you could revive them by doing like a march with like 10 people, in like with like, you know, 50 police officers surrounding you. Or something.
You're killing me, man. You're killing me.
So I think, but there are a few things that I think can be, drawn out of some of these lessons. Of what happened to some of these movements, as well as kind of things that people aren't doing that maybe people could focus on doing. And it's very relative to where you are at physically, kind of geographically and historically, like what's going on. Like I've heard people, to go back to some of the organizing, going on around like Jackson and the Cooperation Jackson Cushion organizing the Mississippi River Delta. Like I hear people criticize it for multiple reasons. And like I said, like I'm not involved in it. Like I'm kind of just happenstance have met some people involved in it and have brief conversations. I've read about it a little bit. And I agree certain like kind of in an abstract sense with some of these critiques, especially about the electoralism and whatever, and with broader critiques, if you want to get into like the role of how do we kind of conceptualize these political projects and the relationship to kind of this older, like, I don't know, is there such a thing as like the liberatory nationalist kind of tradition or whatever? Like, sure, like I can agree with a bunch of people abstracting on these critiques, but if I was in this kind of position of like living in a place like Jackson or whatever, like I don't see anything wrong with doing that sort of organizing. Like obviously if it's a choice between doing something like that, even if you have critiques of it, then like it's something for people to do, you know? So there's some kind of relative aspects to like organizing kind of where you're at and having it make sense. And it doesn't really make sense to prescribe against that thing in any absolute way. regardless of kind of conditions. But that said, there's a few things I think that they're totally undersaturated in terms of people just don't kind of focus on them at all, or they're maybe just starting to. There was surprisingly little organizing, like labor style organizing, in these like logistics cities until pretty recently. And that's starting to change a little bit. We had this strikes in the Twin Cities and Amazon fulfillment centers, and there's more awareness and attempts to kind of organize across in Amazon style kind of warehouses across the U.S. And that I think is really useful. And that's that's a place where you kind of end up in this kind of classical labor organizing conundrum of how do you engage with people doing this organizing while also kind of avoiding falling into like the participation, the logic of like these business unions that are starting to also be attracted to that. So that's one side of it that's probably like useful for people to focus attention and effort on is actually going out to logistics suburbs and like talking to workers and trying to help with organizing efforts that are already starting to go on there and figure out mechanisms to do that organizing. And a lot of that doesn't necessarily mean just workplace organizing. A lot of it is like organizing around potentially like rent, not necessarily rent control, but like which is more of an electoralist kind of approach, but like focusing on rent as an issue and like housing costs and stuff is probably a better way to unify these logistics workers who are not at a single job for very long frequently. But so there's that sort of thing, which some people are starting to do definitely. And honestly, in many cities, the best I've heard from it, other than like outside of these local kind of shop floor style organizing structures, which are organized frequently through kind of pre-existing little communal networks among like the Somali immigrant community or something like that. Aside from that sort of stuff, some of the better organizing that I have seen in terms of like logistics, kind of employment workers and kind of rent issue kind of stuff is all much of it has been raised by this kind of new influx of new, younger, more like less crazy members into like the DSA and stuff. And so I don't like, even if I completely disagree with like a bunch of their other strategy, like I think that has to be just recognized that a lot of the people I've met who do like organizing and like Amazon and stuff, like they also kind of are involved with like the DSA. So it's not easy to prescriptively just write everything off. On top of that, one thing that I think needs a lot more focus and that would be a good project in many places, not necessarily in every place. There's plenty of cities where this would just be kind of a waste of time, but would be disaster response kind of trainings. And so if you kind of imagine what this would maybe look like in after looking at these floods in Nebraska. But I talk in the book about similar kind of disaster stuff going on in along the Mississippi River, and then in Louisiana and in the St. Louis kind of area with flooding. But basically, it's this weird situation where after disasters like that happen, who's actually there? It's kind of FEMA, which sucks and is like not very good, and has some very clear blind spots, like they won't give you services if you're undocumented frequently. And then on top of that, it's like these weird right-wing church groups. And then it's like these weird kind of militia-ish formations in some areas. So when we're thinking about what's going on in those disasters, like you have to recognize that that's going to become more common, obviously, as we're starting to see. It's going to be a perpetual state in some states like Louisiana. And it just makes so much sense. Like why, if you're like interested in like communist or anarchist organizing or whatever, like it seems like such an obvious kind of opening to be able to just do basic kind of trainings and gather some resources and go around and help people during disasters. Right. Some people did do, you know, some of this during Hurricane Sandy. So that I don't think the logic is completely like, it's like not like nobody has done it, but it's something that I think should be a much more kind of central thing in an era of these massive, you know, climate disasters continually. Like it should just be like in many ways it should be kind of the default state for for any kind of left-wing organizing. If we take like a organizing, like historically organizing on like kind of upper, how to phrase it? Like kind of skilled workers was historically the kind of bedrock of like the historical workers movement and the historical kind of communist movement and a lot of the early syndicalist movement. Like their most active kind of participants and members were kind of these, not the complete manual laborers, but the people who were like skilled, but like weren't quite engineers, you know? If that was like the kind of default bedrock organizing in a previous era, it sort of makes sense that like this sort of disaster kind of response capability could serve as kind of a default thing that basically all left-wing, any attempt at like left-wing organizing in almost any part of the US or the world should pretty like much know how to do, you know?
Totally. I mean, again, there's like so many like the subtle nuances of your writing is just the way you like you'll tie in, you know, incarcerated firefighters with global warming, with the failures of capitalism and the destruction of rural areas. And like, I feel like this is, there's so many like just crazy examples like that in the book that we don't really have time to go through every single one of these, but like, you know, what you're saying with, you know, the need to engage in those kinds of mutual aid projects, because that's where we're headed.
It's kind of an effort. It's a situation of kind of tailing things that are kind of organic organizing efforts that do arise. Cause the thing is the material conditions of having all these disasters happen, there's going to be organic organizing that arises out of it as disaster response. It's not like you parachute in some leftists from the city, right, with a bunch of bottled water. It's more the fact that this organizing is going to be developing in these areas. It's already developing, and the people who are basically ending up branding a lot of that organizing, ending up like diverting it to political kind of ends, are like these weird church groups or these like right-wing militias. And so it seems natural that like that sort of area of combat should involve kind of left-wing forces as well. And it just kind of doesn't as much right now. But the thing is, the left is also not in any sense a mass movement. And so when we're talking about mass movements arising, we're not talking about activists and thinkers and stuff deciding like, well, what should we do? We're talking about massive numbers of people who are being put in conditions where organizing and thinking about political stuff is beginning to happen. So that's kind of like the historical movement of the class in kind of classical terms. And what that means is that we often approach it kind of like this question that I think we started this portion of the talk with, which is kind of like, well, what should we do? You know, what should we do or something like that. But in one sense, it's really the wrong, it's a fine question to ask as an individual, like, what should I do? Like, that's great. But if we frame it as like this big kind of what should like the left do, like I was talking about, there's these prescriptive things don't really make sense. One reason they don't make sense, maybe the main reason they don't make sense, other than the fact that people live in different conditions and stuff, is also that we is like very small. It's like not a mass movement. It's not like we're guiding the forces in, you know, one direction or another. It's like we're talking about a very small handful of people who, yeah, have like, I don't know, Twitter accounts or something, but like probably don't have almost any resources to do anything, have some media influence. And so what that conversation ends up being is just a conversation about how do we like engage in discourse or like mobilize our minuscule resources of time and money that we do have toward some inevitably very small scale organizing endeavor, because, you know, we don't have the capacity to support anything larger. So really it's a matter of also shifting the focus to say, well, where is this organic organizing going to arise, and where is it already arising, and does it have this kind of potential to become kind of a left-wing mass movement, something that is kind of has a communist character to it, that maybe is not developed right now. And then, of course, it's a problem if the only people who are politically engaging with that are like the far right militias or whatever. But it's not like this kind of thing of like you're going to preach politics to these people or something. It's already got kind of a political content that's developing through it. And what I think we see with the failure of the far right to become a mass movement is that a lot of the more inherently communistic aspects of this organic organizing as it's been happening has just shown a resistance to being co-opted by the far right very easily. And what that means is that the movement's kind of die out because there's no real way to keep them going infrastructurally or whatever. And there's also not like a lot of engagement, but it does. I think it's a much better sign than people often portray it to be, because I think it shows that there's some aspects of this kind of communal desire that people have that are not as easily co-optable by the far right. And I think that people are starting to talk about some of the questions that I think will orient toward, help us orient toward kind of a larger consciousness about certain things. You see it kind of moving slowly. Like a lot of people talk about how it's like surprising or whatever that we could have a candidate like Bernie Sanders do so well. But really, I think what's fascinating when you look at like the way that over the past 10 years, the way that just the popular political discussions have kind of moved has been that they've been very chaotic and kind of open, which is a good thing in general. Part of the bad stuff that comes out of that is that you get this revival of stuff like the alt-right, because there is this kind of when the center kind of collapses, you don't have the normal kind of standards of like liberalism or whatever, are not necessarily dictating things in the same way. But at the same time, like it's fascinating, right? That one of the candidates most rapidly increasing in popularity, right, in the Democratic primaries is a guy talking about automation and UBI, universal basic income, which you never would have thought like a candidate might have like had any kind of success bringing up in previous election cycles, you know? And those, I think talking, when we start to see political discussion shift toward things like automation, these kind of deeper structural economic problems, that's when you begin to essentially broach the same kind of topics that all of contemporary kind of communist theory is founded on, and is really talking about very much of the slowdown of growth, overall, generally, the increase in automation, which gets kind of wrongfully portrayed as just post-industrial economies, but they're really still industrial, but they, you know, a lot of machines. And then all the social effects that you have from that, like all these people who might otherwise, especially these younger, or not even necessarily younger, but like these men who are put out of these industrial jobs, who then very easily recruitable into kind of far right, or where that language of right resentment kind of has good play. So it's fascinating, right, that we have this Asian guy running on the Democratic primary who's going and talking to these like truckers about what they're going to do when we have self-driving trucks.
Right. And then Baked Alaska is making songs about it. I mean, talk about how fucking just, yeah, that's crazy. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, you say specifically in your book, like, no one knows what's coming. No one has a crystal ball. History doesn't predict anything, you know? But in the same sense, it's like, you know, I did want to get an idea from you of like what, you know, what you thought would be meaningful. You know, one thing I thought was interesting in your book that I just kind of want to throw out there is like another cool thing about that you talk about in the book is like how the excerpts are also a really interesting area for militant struggle, because like there aren't so many cameras, there's more like trees to hide behind. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I'm talking a little bit more about like not the exurbs there and more like these inner ring suburbs like Ferguson.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's also true for the exurbs, but there's not that sort of thing is necessarily going on in those exurban like white flight type excerpts.
All right. Well, so is there anything, so, you know, I have my, these are my generic questions at the end. I just ask everyone. I feel like I could probably talk to you for another 6 hours, but I'm sure you have other things to do today. So is there anything else that's like, you know, through the course of this conversation that you feel like, you know, we've missed or that you want to tack on to this conversation that, you know, that's like on your mind as we're winding down?
No, not necessarily. I mean, there's some general things like I've emphasized kind of throughout, and maybe just kind of summarizing them of like when we have these discussions, and part of the way I kind of wrote the book, I think it's important, like whenever we have all these kind of abstract political discussions, that it's very important that we use good data and we bring data into it. And we also kind of use that additional knowledge that comes from like not kind of reading data or book learning, but like when you're talking about when we were talking about like farming, right? Like it is kind of important to actually understand what that entails at this kind of bodily level. So there's this kind of embedded, embodied knowledge. And so it's important to use all those things when we kind of talk about this stuff, because a lot of it happens at this very abstract level. You know, on top of that, some of the other things that I kind of emphasize in the book and emphasized here are we can't use kind of purely historical models to read the present. And we also can't be kind of prescriptive when it comes to just these general kind of political things. As much as I may agree kind of in this abstract sense with everybody when they talk about like the new kind of rise of democratic socialist, social democracy type politics, which is really just kind of Johnson era liberalism in the US. But, you know, and then they have to talk about how the social democrats killed Rosa Luxemburg. And it's like, yeah, that's all true. But like Bernie Sanders did not kill Rosa Luxemburg, you know? And I disagree with all of his politics, of course. And it has its own limits, but we have to understand those limits in the contemporary context, which are more kind of a matter of understanding, well, what actually happens if we had like a Sanders presidency, like what would be the historical experience of that? And where kind of would that kind of lead people? So in some respects, it is just very important, I think, to focus on kind of like what people are actually doing and what they're like, people kind of as people individually, and then also just not be prescriptive about politics and not take these historical kind of models as a given, because the far right isn't going to look like it used to look like. It's not going to look like what it looks like now in the future. And then, like I said, like even if I might disagree with like a bunch of the stated politics of people in like of the DSA, for example, like you just have to acknowledge when people are doing work that they are doing. And it's interesting that the people that I do know who are doing logistics organizing, like there's people from many different kind of backgrounds, but like there's a good chunk of them who are like DSA organizers, you know? So you have to kind of acknowledge stuff like that. Yeah. On top of that, I don't have that much else to add. Oh, going back to one of the very first things we talked about, if you are interested more in those questions about China, in a slightly more kind of not academic, but like a more theoretical and like in a detailed theoretical kind of engagement, I would look at the Chuang Project, which is chuangcn.org is their website. And that's a great resource for understanding kind of what's going on in contemporary China. But yeah, no, I don't really have much to add other than that.
Awesome. Well, my last question is always what are you geeking out on as far as books right now? Or do you have like a book that you recommend other than your own, if people liked what you had to say?
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of different stuff. Some of it's for kind of academic research. I guess I give a few suggestions kind of based on what people are into. For people who are into like
the kind of theory side of it and like how contemporary communist theory and contemporary Marxism is kind of developing. There's a couple really good books that are pretty new that focus on some of that stuff. And so, of course, like reading Endnotes is important if you haven't. It's a little bit older, but there's this guy. I don't speak Japanese, so I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but Kohei Saito, who is probably is one of the best books on digging into kind of Marxist theory, and it's specifically focusing on how do we understand the ecological aspects of Marxist thought, but through like a really detailed engagement in the original German with Marx's notebooks, and looking at this kind of theory of metabolic rift and how Marx understood soil science and how he engaged with all these early thinkers. It's something that I'm using in thinking about writing, kind of very slowly, kind of composing what might be a later book on how kind of communist thought kind of relates to these ecological questions, like we were talking about at the end. So that's a very good book if you're interested in that.
What's
kind
the
of
book
theory.
Called, though?
Oh, it is called, I think it's called the, let me just double check, Karl Marx's Eco-Socialism. And it's subtitled Capital, Nature, and the Unfinished Critique of Political Economy. So that's a very good book. Something that I think is a little bit more accessible and just kind of a good general overview of how data works and how like a lot of this economic data that we hear and that I use and how it's a little bit deceptive is, let me just find the name of the author. The book is called The Divide. And I am blanking on the author's name. Just one sec. Let me actually go look at the book. I'll be right back.
Sure. Matt Taibbi?
Yeah, sorry. The guy's name is Hickel, Jason Hickel, and he wrote a book called The Divide. And it's basically about tearing into these like the ways that we use like poverty data globally and GDP data and economic data, and kind of showing the kind of myth structure that's built up around these sort of statistics. It's written very accessibly compared to this more kind of theoretical takes on the same stuff. And it's very good in terms of just building kind of general literacy around data and whatnot. Yeah, that's, I can't really think of that much else.
Yeah, I just looked at it. I was like, oh, by Matt Taibbi, The Divide?
No. Yeah, there's a bunch of books called The Divide. That's why I was wanting to make sure I got the name of the author. Yeah, so it's Jason Hickel.
Awesome. And if people, want to follow you or support your work, is there like a best way to do that? Like if they want to engage with you on the internet catch your hot takes.
Yeah, I don't really do hot takes. I do like cold takes. I ice cold takes. I usually sit and wait on stuff and don't do the whole
that's good
media thing. So I don't have a Twitter, but people can kind of follow. I guess. Yeah, I don't really do the kind of media presence thing. I don't do a ton of interviews and stuff like that either. If people need to get in contact with me, they can find that out on the Ultra page. Some of the things I've authored on there have kind of a link to an email. But yeah, if you go look at like Ultra, there is an Ultra Twitter. It's not very heavily used, but yeah, people,
For a small fee, I can put people in touch with you.
Yeah, exactly. it was one of those things where I know that this is a thing a lot of people do, kind of like the boosterism at the end, like follow me on Patreon or whatever. But I just don't really do that. Like if somebody wants like a pirated copy of my book or something, like I don't know. I'm sure they can find someone to hook them up with that. The other stuff is just kind of, yeah. Like if someone has a very specific purpose to get in touch with me, that's great. You can pass on my contact info to them if they get in touch with you. But other than that, I don't do the whole media presence, Twitter hot take thing.
No, I think it's great. And I think it's, you know, why you are, you know, producing. The proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed this conversation. Like, again, I got the idea that you were like a real reclusive dude. So I wasn't sure like how hard it was going to be to talk to you. And, you know, it was awesome. So I really, you know, much respect and, you know, love your work. And when you get done with the food agriculture stuff, I'd love to read that. So I guess if you could keep me in mind and just send it to me.
Yeah, I will.
Awesome. Well, you know, enjoy your day. And yeah, thanks for coming on the motherfucking Soulcast.
Yeah, thanks. Of it, so it goes. That's a not so young poet makes bullets. No talking, no vision. They say you either boot licking or you grave digging these days. Everybody that I see was either born into money or had to learn to work hard and hope you get lucky. Maybe both. Be happy if you never had to learn to rip a motherfucker off or watch your best friend get shot by the cops. In the 90s, all I saw was layoffs. Sorry, generation, like nobody wants your labor. Bosses never like me. It was mutual. No slow funeral. Young don't like cubicles. If there's blood in your veins, let it spill. I'm in my field. In the field gives way to condos being built. They bottle it up, sell it back in a form of pills. You can't stare it in the face. That's how you know that it's real. Democrats in an open air prison. No ballot box to stop the jungles aflaming. Streets named after fallen Indian tribes. Europeans named them. Indians at the art museum. Colonizers painted them. Sand Creek Massacre under my feet. And don't say that on my property deed. They stole the globe and born fat of the surplus. Destroyed all economies and abolished the workers. Some bought diplomas that cost more than houses. No surprise not having a boss feels like a revolutionary project. Terrifying times, terrifying memes. Terror levies fines, terror owns the streams. They did not say that how long rain is guaranteed to fall. But we all know how little freedom that the so-called law allows. You in a mold, but that was like 10,000 years ago. They still build pyramids, millions of tiny ones driven by a deeper sphere. Power between our ears, even though our thoughts are segmented. I'll be eternally fighting a part of me that's scared to death. With it, I'm only human, staring at a train wreck. They teach respect with a whip and a checkbook. You can work your fingers till the marrows are dead. Today's laminated badge, tomorrow's arrowhead. They'll hydrofrack your yard, no one to cry to. Cause a dark force owns a literal ground beneath you. On their merits they perish. The land of get their faces and granted. The rest in a flurry of panic. But even the occupants